You should, from reading the material that I sent out, you should probably be able to guess that there's in large measure agreement among most people that I think of as being really good Bible students on the first part of Matthew. There's some disagreement about the second part of Matthew. And when we get there and we talk about the part after verse 36, then I won't hesitate to tell you what my interpretation is, my understanding of that. But the material after verse 36 in Matthew 24 is treated a little bit differently in the text that was written by Wayne Jackson and the text that was written by Brent Kirchhoffel. So we'll talk about that. And I wanted to give you this because it's important that you know that there are different perspectives on how to understand the second part of Matthew 24 and whether it should be linked to Matthew 25. So we'll begin tonight, and I should also mention that Matthew 24 is the longest treatment of this material. You see the same material or the same time period that's treated in Mark 13 and in Luke 21, but Matthew's account is by far the longest and most detailed account. So that's where we're kind of going to focus, but I do want you to bring in Mark 13 and Luke 21, wherever that's appropriate. And I sent you the material. There's some questions that you can work through that'll help get you thinking about these things. And then there's the biblical text of Matthew 23, 24, and 25. And Mark 13 and Luke 21. And then there's the article that was written by Brent and the article that was written by Wayne. And so you have a lot of information to read through. And it's important that you consider all of this information. There is other material that is worthwhile. I just chose these two articles. They were suggested in some material that I found at Embry Hills, and I found them to be very helpful. So let's get into a discussion of this part of Matthew. Any other thoughts before we begin this section of our study? Okay, let's start by setting the context for the statements that Jesus makes in Matthew 24. And the way to do that is to go back to the beginning of Matthew 23. Matthew 23 is one of Jesus' sternest denouncements of the Pharisees and their moral character and their behaviors that you'll find anywhere in the New Testament. Jesus, toward the end of his personal ministry, is getting fed up with the way the Pharisees have mutilated the Old Testament. And he's not only is he fed up with the Pharisees, but he's fed up that the people of Jerusalem in general have listened to them. They just sort of blindly followed them because the Pharisees set themselves up as being the repository of all knowledge. They compared themselves to a cistern that had been sealed up and that never leaked, so any knowledge that came their way, they retained it. But the people had not actually looked at the Old Testament information. Instead, they just listened to the Pharisees. And because of that, not only are the Pharisees going to be destroyed because of their lack of moral character and their behavior, the people are also going to suffer because they followed them. So let's start reading in Matthew 23 at, I think the best place to start reading is about verse 2. Somebody want to start reading in Matthew 23 at verse 2? Yeah, am I? Did you have something, Eileen? Okay. Who would like to read verses 12 through, or verses 2 through 12 in Matthew 23?
I'll start that, Dean. The scribes and the Pharisees had seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds. For they say things and do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor at the banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whosoever exalts him shall be humbled, and whosoever humbles himself shall be exalted.
It's a pretty dire picture that he presents of the Pharisees. They, like I said, they considered themselves to be the smartest person in the room. And whenever you were around them, you couldn't talk to Charlie. You had to talk to Rabbi Charlie. And there was no reason for that. Then Jesus corrects all of this. He says, you have one master, and that word master there means teacher. That's God. You have one father. That's God. You have one who should be called rabbi or should be called teacher. And that's God. But these people want to be elevated to a position that they don't deserve. And, you know, I have been around people that were like that. I've made the observation before that when somebody insists on being addressed as teacher loony or teacher dean, it's usually because they don't command very much respect because of what they're saying. It's a false way for them to get respect. And that's true even when a lot of what they say is true. That's why Jesus would say, everything that they're telling you, do it. They're basically telling you the right stuff, but they're not doing it themselves, and they want to take the authority away from God to be the ones that tell you to do it. So it's very dangerous when you see this kind of an attitude. And we've all probably encountered it at one time or another. And the dangerous thing about this is that many times what they're saying really is true, and it's the kind of thing that we ought to be doing, but they're getting it out of perspective. Comments, thoughts about this part of what he has to say about the Pharisees.
Isn't that just what went on in the garden with the serpent? He wanted the authority for himself. He wanted the power for himself. Isn't that the problem with sin, is that we all take the power ourselves?
Well, that's true, and that's a good point. The difference between the Pharisees and Satan was Satan only told them lies. The Pharisees didn't necessarily tell them lies. The Pharisees might have, and Jesus says, listen to what they're saying. What they're telling you to do is correct, but it's destroyed because of their character. Now, with Satan, you're right. The prime problem that we have with sin is we take the authority away from God. With Satan, Satan actually told them lies.
Well, in a way, they do say a lie, because they want to say the authority comes from them and not from God. So, although what they're saying is the truth, there is a lie in there, just like Satan just added the word not.
Well, that's true. That's true. And the fact that they want to take the power away from God is a critical downfall. Absolutely. And we're going to see that when we look at restoration history. The people that were influential in leading the restoration were saying, don't listen to us, listen to God. And we'll see that when we talk about the last will and testament of the Springfield Presbytery tomorrow night. So take some time to read through that. That's really, really, really fascinating. They made a big move when they said, we must get back to just the Bible. Okay. Other comments? Well, now let's read verses 13 through 32, and this is a listing of 8 woes that Jesus pronounces on the Pharisees. this is a this pronouncing woes is kind of a Jewish art form. It's very common in their language. You see it in the book of Habakkuk. But in the book of Habakkuk, it's God pronouncing woes on the Babylonians. Here, it's woes that come to the Pharisees because of what they're doing, and there are eight of them. So let's look at these eight. Somebody want to read verses 13 through 32?
I can read those. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, where you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Justice and mercy, have faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone, blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of your father's guilt.
This is brutal.
Yeah.
And he uses that phrase to introduce this over and over again. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites. The scribes were the lawyers, the people that wrote the law. They were the people that interpreted it. They were the lawyers of their day. Pharisees were the teachers. The hypocrite is a really interesting word. And it at its root, the word hypocrite means one that speaks for another. So it's not in our language, hypocrite is just a nasty word. We hate the word or the idea of a hypocrite. But this is the word that they would use for a person that was an actor. He's saying the words of another. And what they wanted you to think was that they were just spokesmen for God. This wasn't what they were saying. This was what God was saying, and you had to do it. So just those three terms to refer to them are really brutal in and of themselves. So let me ask this question. Do you see people today who are like the scribes and the Pharisees and the hypocrites in terms of their character?
I certainly did in Europe.
Okay. Can you expand on that a little, Faye?
The priest ran the village in the mountains, in the small villages. The priest was the head guy, no matter what the government was. He had the final word in everything, and behind the scenes, it wasn't really that pretty.
That's an interesting observation. I kind of encountered that in the culture in old Mexico, where you would go into a Mexican village where everybody is dirt poor except for the priest. And they have a beautiful building that sits mostly empty, but it's kind of like Faye was saying in Europe. Anybody else?
There's regions that like really pride themselves, or like conservative states really pride themselves on the title of Christian, and it's I don't know, it's kind of like people are just hold themselves up higher because they go to church once a week, and then the second they get out of church, it's almost like they never even went. That's why for so many years I was confused about just being a Christian, and it was almost just a title where you didn't have to earn it.
Well, and I'm like you, I wouldn't want to have anything to do with that kind of an organization.
Yeah.
What about the Pope?
He might be the living embodiment of this kind of philosophy. Now, he's talking about the scribes and the Pharisees and the hypocrite, the scribes and the Pharisees. A lot of what he says about them is true today of the Pope. That's not who he's talking about. He's talking about the Pharisees, but you see these things repeated over and over again. And that's one of the things that can get us into trouble when we start trying to understand what Jesus says later in Matthew 24. Because it's so easy for us to look at the society that we live in and say, yeah, our society is just like that. That he's describing us to a T, and he does. Like Matt said, you know, Christian is just a name you wear, and inside you're like you're full of dead men's bones. You're like the whitewashed tombs of the prophets. And they did venerate the prophets. They venerated those people that had gone before them. And they actually did go out and whitewash these tombs so that they would be beautiful. We ought to instead wash the inside and not be so worried about the outside. Within, they're full of extortion and excess, he says. What about this phrase where he says, you have tithed mint and anise and cumin, these little seeds. You go so far as to count out a tenth of those little seeds, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Are we ever guilty of that? We strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. They, when the Pharisees would drink from a cup, they would take a handkerchief and they would wrap their hand in the handkerchief so that they didn't touch the cup. And if they poured water out of the cup, they actually did strain it through a cloth. So that no uncleanness, because if a bug got into their drink, that made the drink unclean. So they would actually do that kind of thing. And it wasn't just the Pharisees, the Essenes that lived out in the desert, the Qumran community. They got caught up in the same kind of thing. They participated in ceremonial washings. They called them baptisms. So that's really what it is. It was a ceremonial baptism. And they argued that if you were going to be baptized, you had to be baptized in flowing water. So you couldn't pump water into a pool and then be baptized in that water. It had to be naturally flowing into the pool. So they would have, it got really ridiculous. There are places where they found where they had just a trickle of water coming into the pool, and they said, oh, it's living water. Well, they'd fill the pool up with buckets. Because the little trickle that came in wasn't enough to have filled up the pool. It's so easy to get hung up this way and to slip into this kind of character. Whosoever swears by the altar, then it's nothing. But if you swear by the gift that's on the altar, then it matters. How silly is that? Other comments, other thoughts? Okay, let's look at verses 33 through 39. Can I get somebody to read that?
Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar.
Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon your this generation. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate, for I say to you, from now on, you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.
As I read these words, I see Jesus with tears in his eyes. How much more could I do? How much I have loved you, and yet you just reject me. So I see this is a time when Jesus is terribly disappointed in his people that should have accepted him. So this is where, especially beginning in verse 37, Jesus turns his attention to Jerusalem. Now in verse 36, he says, I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation. And we'll talk a little bit more about the importance of that phrase as we continue this discussion. But Jesus makes it clear. These people have brought this judgment upon themselves. And in verse 39, remember how we talked about the day of the Lord? He says, you won't see me from now on till you say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. So I'm coming in judgment. And when I come, it's going to be something that you have earned. So now let's transition to Matthew 24. And when we transition to Matthew 24, let's just read verses 1 through 3, and we'll take a break at that point, and we'll come back and we'll talk about this a little bit more next week. So Matthew 24.
Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, do you not see all these things? Truly, I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?
And verse 3. Oh, you read verse 3.
Yeah, I did.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
So here is the occasion for the discussion in Matthew 24. He's just talked about how he is lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem. And it's unfortunate, I think, that there's a chapter break here, because it destroys the flow of the narration, or the rhythm of the narration. He's just been talking about how Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, and then he gets more specific. He says, time is coming when there's not going to be one stone left on another. And his disciples say, and the disciples really ask the kind of question that I would ask. If I heard somebody say, America's going to be destroyed, there will not be left any city in America, my first thought would be, when? You know, I'm terrified of this, especially if I know that you have the ability to carry this out. My first thought is going to be the thought that was expressed exactly by the apostles. When? Now, notice how the apostles, when they describe this, they say, what is the sign of your coming? And what is the sign, or when is the end of the world? Well, here in Matthew 24, in verse 3, this is that word that we talked about before that's translated age. It's the Greek word 165, and it's A-I-O-N. We kind of brought that into the English language, and we call it an eon of time. So what's going to be the sign of the end of the age? Is it the end of the world? And the King James, unfortunately, translates this the end of the world. So a lot of times we make a mistake and we see world and we immediately think this is the final judgment when everything stops. That's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus has been pronouncing woes on the scribes and the Pharisees and the Jewish nation and the theocracy. And the apostles say, when is this age coming to an end? You're talking about the end of an era. When is this going to happen? But it's the end of the age, not the end of the world. Comments about that, the difference between the end of the world and the end of the age. You have to remember that the temple to the Jews was everything. It should have been everything. I mean, it was the dwelling place of God, but they let it get to be something that it shouldn't have been. They said, because we have the temple, we are acceptable to God. And it doesn't matter what we do. And that was a mistaken notion, but nevertheless, it was one that they entertained. So when Jesus says, I'm going to tear this temple down, I'll destroy it. 3 days later, I'll rebuild it. Oh, that's what got Jesus in trouble. Now, he was talking about the temple of his body at that point, but here he's talking about you guys revel in having the temple. I can take this away. This is not a big deal. And remember, when the Romans came against the city of Jerusalem and they laid siege to the city of Jerusalem, the different factions within Judaism were fighting with each other. And Josephus indicates that it was not the Romans that burned the city, and totally dismantled it. It was the factions within the Jews that were fighting with each other that burned the city and dismantled it. The Romans came in and they just kind of cleaned up. They had heard, yes, they had heard that there was gold and that was overlaying the temple, and the fires may have let it run down in the cracks between the stones. And yes, they did. Look for that gold. But the shameful thing for the Jews was, it wasn't the Romans that destroyed it. That wasn't the general MO of the Romans. But the Jews started the fires, and burned the city, and the Romans, Josephus says it was almost like the Romans got mad. So when they came in, they completed the destruction.
Well, we know that there is a sign, because he said, when you see this coming, you run to the hills and don't stay in the city because it's going to be destroyed. So
right.
He gave them a chance to leave even at that.
But, right. Now, that would make no sense if he was talking about the end of the world, because at the end of the world, everybody comes into judgment. You can go out in the mountains and hide, but God will find you.
And there's a difference between the world, the people are the world, and then there's the land of the world. So they're different terms.
That's true.
And not the same word.
That's true. So we'll talk a little bit more about the signs that the apostles could look for. And it wasn't just the apostles. It was the rest of the Christians. The signs that they could look for that would allow them to escape this awful judgment that God was bringing on the theocracy. And they did. For the most part, the Jews, the Christians left the city of Jerusalem, and they went out into the mountains to the town of Pella, and they started a church there. So they escaped the worst part of the siege. Now, that was because they were looking at the signs. They were actively paying attention to what was going on. Now, a lot of people read this and they focused on the King James translation of verse 3. What's the sign of the end of the world? That's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking about the judgment on Jerusalem. It's the end of that age. And because they've missed the context, they didn't look at Matthew 23 in order to set the stage for what's said in the first three verses of Matthew 24. They come up with a wrong conclusion.
Peter tells us what our sign is going to be. It's just going to be zapped and just gone. So we don't have a sign other than that, because we don't know when the Lord is coming.
That's true. And we'll talk about that. You know when it's coming. But here he's saying, you know that it's close. Mm-hmm. You don't know what day it's going to happen. You know it's close. So get ready. Sometimes we inadvertently play into the mistake that people make because we're not careful about making sure that when we read these words, we apply them to the right thing. That sometimes we go back and we get one of these passages that we're wanting to use to describe what's going on today, and we take it out of its context and we apply it to what's going on today. And then what we're really doing is adding to the confusion. So you just have to be, you have to be aware, and you have to be careful not to take these things out of context. Okay, I want to stop there. And next week we'll continue and we'll talk about the signs that would help to answer the apostles' questions. And that'll start in verse 4. And if you can, go through all of these different passages that are listed. These are listed in the study guide that Embry Hills put out when they did this study. So see if you can see the sign that's in each one of these passages, verse 6, verse 7, verse 9, verse 10. And then we'll talk about those next week.